Hey folks, before we dive into the show, we wanted to share some important news. Misdirected Mark Productions is becoming the Polygamers Podcast Network. Same shows, but a new network name. On April 15th, we will be changing over our current podcast feed to the new addresses at polygamero.us. If you're using a podcatcher, this should be seamless and you shouldn't see any difference, but if you do, please reach out and let us know. If you're using a direct feed, you will need to update to the new URL. You don't want to miss us because we're freaking delightful. You can get more information and the new URLs at polygamero.us. That is polygamero.us. Polygamero.us.
From the Bannock Couch. There have been several adventures over the years that have blended fantasy and sci-fi. But one that doesn't get referenced as much as Expedition to the Barrier Peaks or City of the Gods is the 1997 adventure Tale of the Comet. Wait a minute, I read that novel when I was a kid. Isn't that just more Expedition to the Barrier Peaks? Anyways, eventually the PCs head to a science fiction setting to defeat the final villain that gets us through a technological portal. There are rules for converting characters to the alternative game system. The science fiction RPG TSR was just beginning to launch, which also had a StarCraft setting. The final boss is an evil AI that ruined the world by stealing all of the art and writing in the culture that created it. Or maybe it destroyed every living being on the planet with drones? I can never keep it straight. It's very Terminator up in here. And now we present to you Thacko with Advantage.
Welcome to Thacko with Advantage. We're two friends that have been playing D&D a long time. While we love lots of other RPGs, D&D is a recursive program that we're still running to solve for a perfect campaign.
Hi, I'm Ange, and I've been gaming for over 35 years. In 2014, I started writing for Gnome Stew, and I've been running the podcast for Gnome Stew, the Gnomecast, since 2017. And in 2021, I started running Gnome Stew. So, you know, there you go.
A biggie. And I'm Jared, the review gnome at Gnome Stew, and I've been gaming since roughly 1985. In addition to writing reviews at Gnome Stew, I've got my own site, whatdoinojr.com, where I write additional reviews and opinion pieces on a variety of RPGs.
After we look at the games we're running or playing in the campaign journal, we'll be talking about adding science fiction into our D&D games. Then we're going to have certain recommendations for D&D-related content for you to check out in our downtime research segment.
Let me just finish up this campaign journal.
After quite the drought, I got to play in all three of my regular D&D games.
Nice.
Jared's going to talk about his, but I'll talk about the other two. So with City of Cowls, we had missed a month of gaming due to the GM being on vacation and then the GM following that up with plague from the vacation. It is what it is. I don't think it was actually COVID, but it still knocked him and his whole family on their butt after the vacation. He still wasn't feeling 100% when we played, but he was at least up for running part of our normal session. We picked up right where we left off in the Badlands, trying to find any lost survivors of our barbarian Rees Dragonborn clan, the Rage Drakes. We had fought off some demons near a tunnel entrance last session, so this session had us going into those tunnels and fighting a running battle through them. We weren't sure the clan was in there, but those demons were awfully interested, so we figured we'd be rescuing someone. I have cats, and if there is a mouse somewhere in this house, the cats will be very interested in that spot. This is what those demons were doing. Right inside of the entrance, we had a fight with a whole horde of Blazow? Basically, they're demons that stink a lot. Which led to me shouting as my character Dove, "Why does the apocalypse smell so bad?" Those were joined by a very nasty Yawklaw, which we destroyed with extreme prejudice because it kind of scared all of us. We never left initiative as we ran through the tunnels fighting demons. Eventually, we found her clanmates defending a whole bunch of non-combatants in a large cavern in the back, where they were facing off with three larger demons, a Vrock, a Barlgura, and a Glabrazu. And a whole bunch of their clanmates were possessed and fighting them as well. It was a pretty intense fight and a whole lot of fun because Modrin was able to get off a banishment on the Glabrazu, which took him out of the fight completely, let us focus on the other two, which ended up freeing up her clanmates from the the mind-altering stuff that was happening to them, and then we could focus solely on the big bad when he came back. We ended up taking a breather and then shepherding the remnants of the clan back to kind of their safe spot. They had basically an ancient wizard tower that was warded against demonic, infernal interference, so the clan could gather there a bit more safely. While we were debating our next move and what we wanted to do next, a whole other clan showed up. These were the Moon Owls, I think. Yeah, the Moon Owls. They're a clan from south of where the Rage Drakes normally live. They were also pretty decimated, and they were proposing that the two clans join up. But they were doing this with kind of a hedged wariness, because by tradition, this would have meant a fight between the two leaders of the clans to see who claimed dominance. But Rhee is on a quest to unite the Dragon Clan, the Dragonborn clans, to help against this demon horde. So she proposed, rather than following the old ways, let's just form a new clan, which they shockingly agreed to. So they are now the Thunderdrakes, which is a play on the Thundercranes, which is something that Anu has been trying to get us to call the whole group since the very beginning of our campaign.
You know, when you mentioned the banishment, for all of the headaches that banishment sometimes cause DMs, that is exactly what banishment should do, is get rid of one of the nasty things so that you can have some breathing room.
Yes, yes. In the other game, we had left off with us in the middle of a heist, trying to steal some stuff from a vault. We couldn't actually leave because the whole place was warded against teleporting out, and so we were a little stuck. Now, one thing with this group is that they always make things way more complicated than it needs to be. Based on what we did for our exit strategy, we should have probably been able to be on to the next thing within about 40 minutes. Instead, it took us almost 2 hours, because debating and discussing and debating and discussing and making sure everything is absolutely perfect, and I'm like, can we please make this a now problem?
So there's nothing to throw a fireball at in order to prompt nothing, things to move
I
faster?
I don't throw fireballs. And honestly, playing Selena in this campaign, I do try and take a back seat so I'm not hurting the fun of everyone else at the table. But at the same time, there are points where I'm just like, oh, for the love of God, can we just get to the monkey? We ended up handing over the circlet we were sent in to steal. We showed up to hand this over to the dwarf that hired us. Well, lo and behold, there was this elven woman there who looked very put out. And she turned out to be his ex-partner, a business partner, who was the owner of the vault. Things were very tense, but eventually she decided to kind of call things even, since we had, quote-unquote, tested the security of her vault and helped her identify some weaknesses. She also ended up giving us a quest to investigate this cursed shard that was the one thing she didn't want back from the vault. She told us, you know, here's the information I have about it. I will pay you for additional information, but I just want you to take this off my hands and go find out more about it. Again, the group made this all way more complicated than it needed to be. She had given us some gold to give her things back. We were like, kind of holding them as hostage. I don't know. Either way, she was giving us gold, and like Woody's character, Arima, went to all like checking it, you know, if it's magic, checking it for traps. And it's just like, why is she going to trap the gold she's giving us when we're in the middle of a public space and she's asking us to go do something from her? Can we please just stop being completely paranoid? I love them. I love them dearly, but
yeah,
it can get exhausting.
Things happen.
None of it is completely out of the realm of reasonableness.
Mm-hmm.
It's just, it gets to the point where I'm just like, I want to get to the action.
I would like to roll a die and have it mean something. The amazing thing is not only did you get multiple game sessions in after your gaming drought, I got multiple game sessions in after my gaming drought. So in one game, I got to play, which I don't get to do quite as often. Maybe someday we'll talk about that a little bit more. Anyway, so I play in Brandis Stoddard's game, and Brandis Stoddard is a great game designer, look for his name on things and buy them. Anyway, I play in Brandis Stoddard's game, and it is sort of like a West Marches style game where we are all members of this mercenary company, and we have a bunch of open missions that we can go do whenever he says he's going to run things. And the other members of the mercenary company have found the dead body of a Githyanki knight, and my character just happens to be the only Githyanki that is part of the mercenary company. So everyone in that last session was really excited to get me to the same location.
You're probably the only Githyanki they know.
Well, apparently someone in the company has run into one other Githyanki besides the dead one. But we're in this complex, and one of the things that was really interesting about this is everyone in Brandis's game knows the ins and outs of how his world works, but there are times when outside D&D kind of comes to roost in Brandis's game, and my character crashing, you know, into the setting in a spelljammer was one of those things. So Brandis let me be the expert when my character was the expert. So when the other players are asking about, what is this adversary thing that this Githyanki's talking about? And why did we run into a brain with legs? And so I got to go off on this long, long discussion about how horrible mind flayers are and explaining what Seramorphosis is and how they use intellect devourers as basically their guard dogs. And
somebody's been playing Baldur's Gate 3 a little bit.
And then, what was funny, we're almost done with all of this, and just offhandedly I throw out there, is like, oh yeah, and once in a while, if those tadpoles don't burrow into your brain and turn you into a mind flayer, and they survive, they turn into a giant telepathic worm with tentacles. Because who doesn't want to reference Neophthalids in, you know, in a diatribe at some point in time? So, so basically now we have a quest to find the mount of this Githyanki knight. The red dragon that he used to ride has roosted somewhere in the world, and he wants his bones taken and given to his former mount. That is a thing that we will be doing. And also his soul is in the dagger that I'm carrying, so I'm sure that'll be interesting. And also, for reasons that will be, you know, amusing later on, and I believe I've said this before, I'm playing a Circle of Stars druid. Just remember that for future reference.
I have no idea what you are talking about.
We also got our Thursday night game in which I'm the DM, and where we left our party, they were about to fight an Eldritch Lich. If you have not seen an Eldritch Lich before, look at the Spelljammer Monstrous Compendium that came out around the time Spelljammer came out on D&D Beyond. They are fun.
I mean, the relative term.
The Lich with an aberration living inside it. I was enjoying it. I did have a few moments where I, as the DM, was a little scared I was going to TPK the party because I had multiple people at zero hit points. And when one person goes to zero hit points, you're like, okay, this was a serious encounter. When two go down and one of them is the cleric.
Yeah, it was a little scary. I think this was one of the first times, like, Marin and Ivy both constantly joke about what their next character is going to be when they die here. But usually it's joking. Marin was actually starting to sound a little serious about what he wanted to play next.
I mean, the Eldritch Lich got a critical with his tentacle that did over 100 points of damage. So it was pretty serious, but I felt even worse because there were lair actions going on because they were basically raiding a vault. And there were different things that were happening as the vault was reconfiguring itself every round. And this round, it was just a pit trap. And I didn't think anything of the fact that there was a pit trap there because it's a minor inconvenience normally. You would drop, take 1d6 points of damage, have to use, you know, your movement to climb out of it. Not that terrible, just an interesting thing that happened. And I ended up giving two of my party members a failed death save because of that lair action. We did manage to not have a TPK, and part of that is because I managed to roll terribly when the Lich was attacking Ange's rogue, and also Ange was rolling really well saving against its psychic attacks.
I did crit on one of my sneak attacks too.
Yes, that definitely helped. One of the neat things is the Eldritch Lich does not have a soul object. It has this weird thing where the the aberration inside of it like implodes and goes back to the far realm and then reforms the lich and brings it back. So to stop that, normally there's a certain way to stop that from happening so that you can kill the lich good and dead. Because I wanted to showcase that, because I don't know when I'm going to use this thing again, I let them just kind of cut it off from the outer planes by, you know, successfully turning it. At which point, the lich's soul is trapped in the form of an Atyug, which they promptly killed so that that lich would never come back again.
He was very polite, but he wasn't very nice.
They started going through all of the treasure, and there is a ridiculous amount of gold and platinum in this treasury that they found. But they also found a dragon orb. Now, if you've ever read what dragon orbs do, they can summon dragons from other places, and sometimes they can take over dragons. They live in the Dragon Empire, where all of these members of this council are all looking for ways to become more important than other dragons and annex their lands. And they now have a device that is a political time bomb. So that's where we left it, with them trying to figure out what they're going to do with that.
Yep. Yep.
Also, the Sultan of the Dragon Empire has a representative that's with them who witnessed them having a dragon orb, which further complicates the situation.
Yeah. Yeah. Yep.
I am very curious to see what all of you decide to do with that dragon orb. All right, let's move into the Dungeon Master's Workshop. If you look back at Appendix N, the list of books and authors that Gygax included in the Dungeon Master's Guide, you'll see that there are authors who wrote various stories like Sword and Planet stories of John Carter of Mars, as well as stories of people from modern-day Earth being transported to other worlds that also have magic included in them. Lee Brackett, one of the authors on the Appendix N list, wrote a number of Sword and Planet stories in the vein of John Carter, but also criticizing colonialism a little bit more than Edgar Rice Burroughs did in his books. Lee Brackett, you might notice, is one of the people that wrote the screenplay for The Empire Strikes Back, which just happens to be a story about space wizards swinging laser swords at each other. That means that as much as folklore and more traditional fantasy stories comprise the influences of D&D, science fiction is in D&D's DNA as well, even if it's not the dominant gene. Since Quest from the Infinite Staircase will be reprinting an adventure that most people associate with one of those big science fiction fantasy crossovers in D&D, Expedition to the Barrier Peaks, we thought this would be a good time to discuss science fiction in your D&D games. So, Ange, what are some pop culture properties that have touched on crossing over science fiction and fantasy?
Well, you already mentioned Star Wars. Star Wars is a huge one. It is basically fantasy with some science fiction trappings.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's not a lot of grounded actual science in the science fiction of Star Wars, which is why it's more fantasy than science. But it is still very got a lot of those fantasy flavors. Prophecy, swords, magical powers. We just call it the Force, but...
Teddy bears.
I was not able to get into either of these series, but Shannara and Wheel of Time both touch on science fiction trappings in a fantasy setting. I think both of them kind of have a little bit of that far, far future after an apocalypse type of storyline going on in their backgrounds.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting because they are fantasy settings, but then all of a sudden they will find a ruin that was a skyscraper, or they will find a technological item. So, you know, it's not always blending it, but it's in the backstory.
Final Fantasy. I think most of the Final Fantasy stories blend in some of those science fiction elements into, you know, I mean, on the box, it says fantasy, but then they throw in some science fiction shenanigans in there, too.
It's funny because I had the original Final Fantasy for the NES, and I still remember getting close to the end game to fight the boss. And we had an encounter, and the encounter says mech. And you see this mech appears with all of your wizards and your monk and your fighter. And I was like, what?
To a certain degree, I think a lot of the Japanese creators weren't as beholden to keeping science fiction and fantasy separate like Western stories have been. they're just like mash it all up together and throw it out the door. You know, because so many animes are a blend of a little bit of science fiction with a little bit of magic and all sorts of stuff going on.
The other thing is, like, some of the things that we just kind of take for granted, like the Lovecraft mythos, if you really look at that, that was taking things that you would normally, in some stories, describe as demons or, you know, supernatural creatures of that nature, and basically saying, no, they're aliens. Things on other planets are terrible. You never want to go to another planet. But yeah, that's all they are. And that is an interesting way, because it is kind of taking the trappings of something fantastical and then saying, no, there's a scientific explanation for these things. Even magic in Lovecraftian stories is almost more like learning how to do equations and rewriting reality and how it works rather than pulling some kind of elemental force together.
I think there's a fair amount of horror that actually blends both the fantastical and science fiction. I'm not a big fan of the horror genre, but the little bits I know, Pinhead, oh, my brain is freezing a lot, but a lot of them blend science fiction and magic together. The space movie that's terrifying with Lawrence Fishburne in it.
Event Horizon.
Yes, I hate that movie because it scared the crap out of me.
Oh, goodness. It was funny because I was talking to Ange when we were doing the outline for this, you know, for this show. And I was like, you know, it feels like I'm missing some really obvious crossovers between fantasy and science fiction. And I'm getting ready to say this to her as I am watching Masters of the Universe Revolution on Netflix. That is probably one of your biggest blueprints for if you want to run a fantasy campaign, but also have people show up with lasers.
Thundar the Barbarian.
Oh, yeah.
We are showing our age referencing Thundar the Barbarian, but that's stamped science fiction fantasy shenanigans.
Shifting from pop culture in general, how has D&D used science fiction elements in previous editions? Maybe before we got into the year 2000 and later.
Obviously, you mentioned it in the beginning, but Expedition to the Barrier Peaks is one of the foundational adventures that blends science fiction into a D&D setting. It's essentially, I've never actually played this one. I may have played pieces of it back in the 80s because I remember a campaign where we found a submarine or some other fantastical ship that was all technology, but I believe it is the characters finding a spaceship that had crashed into the barrier peaks.
Yeah, you end up running into like androids that, you know, were supposed to do maintenance on the ship, and there's a mind flayer on there, and it's also where we get the wolf in sheep's clothing, which is the thing that looks like a bunny sitting on top of a tree stump that actually has tentacles and a mouth in it.
There's Eberron, which is a little bit more steampunk mixed with D&D, but I still think that qualifies as blending the science fiction and fantasy stuff together. I mean, you've got your lightning rails, you've got your airships, you've got your warforged, you've got a whole bunch of other things going on that are playing with technology in that fantasy setting. So I think that one definitely qualifies.
Oh, yeah.
You're probably better to speak to some of the other older pieces that I'm not as familiar with.
There were several other adventures besides Expedition to the Barrier Peaks that kind of touched on that science fiction fantasy blending. The Blackmoor series that they did for the basic set D&D, that, you know, range of products, that was all the underlying story of that, was that there was like this ancient technological empire that fell a long time ago. So there were elements of that all through the story. And there is one specific adventure in there, City of the Gods, which is basically about exploring the city that is, you know, this fallen technological metropolis. The other one that I can think of was, speaking of mechs, there was Earthshaker, which is basically you are defending your barony and trying to keep other people from claiming a mech before they wreck your barony with it. There's also some things like you were saying, I kind of lump D&D moving into even modern settings kind of in the same category. And what's interesting about that is, like, in Greyhawk, Merlin, who is one of the things that they called a quasi-deity in the setting, was a cowboy. Like, he straight up had six shooters and wore a cowboy hat when he would appear. I also remember the first edition Manual of the Planes had this section, and I love this, where they would have these dials. Like, if you went to an alternate Earth, that would tell you how magical the place was, how technologically advanced it was. And part of that was to tell you, if you go to this alternate Earth, magic barely functions. So you can only use first level spells if you go to this world. And it was really interesting because D&D doesn't look at going to alternate Earths as much these days as it kind of used to, especially now that like all of the D&D worlds are kind of considered the material plane, and they're just separated by vast gulfs of space, not necessarily in another plane.
Do we want to bring up Spelljammer, Jared?
Okay, I'm going to take a breath first. Okay, so one of the things that's always kind of bugged me is that people will refer to Spelljammer as being a science fiction crossover setting for D&D, and it's kind of not, because I think sometimes when people didn't play Spelljammer, they don't understand that you're not getting on technological spaceships, and you're not sailing into an actual void that is like the void between worlds in the real universe. You are sailing on a ship that is magic powered, so you're on a galleon flying through space, and the properties of air means that air clings to your ship long enough for you to still breathe out in the void. Sometimes stars are bright portals to the plane of radiance. Sometimes they're phosphorescent things that the gods painted on the inside of a crystal sphere.
I think there's a fair amount of Spelljammer that feels more science fiction-y than vanilla D&D, but I totally get what you're saying.
Yeah, definitely when they get into some of the monsters they introduce, they kind of went, well, we're in space, we might as well run with this. So it kind of partially invalidates what I'm saying. I'm just saying.
I think if you really want to dig into D&D in space, look at Starfinder.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have a whole lot of experience with it, but I believe it is much more science fiction based. It's all these people lived on Galarian, and now they have advanced their civilization to the point where they can go to space.
All right, speaking of Starfinder, what are some more recent ways that D&D is engaged with science fiction?
I've already talked about Eberron, but I will talk about it again because I will take any opportunity to talk about Eberron. It definitely digs, especially if you engage with any of the facets of the setting that involve the Warforged,
mm-hmm.
can very much dig into some of those science fiction tropes.
Yeah.
Because it is a completely created species.
Yeah.
There's a lot going on there.
You have kind of the same elements of who am I and do I have a soul and what does it mean to be human that you have with stories like Data in Star Trek.
Yeah. Any sort of robot story trope you could bring into play for the Warforged, because they can be clerics. They have been accepted by the divine. They must have a soul, right?
Mm-hmm.
And if they do have a soul, where did it come from? Because they were created to serve as warriors in the last war.
Mm-hmm.
So what is their purpose now that the last war is over? Do they just continue to serve the people that created them, or are they allowed to become their own person? There's a whole lot there to dig into if you wanted to.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I also wanted to touch on one of the things I thought was really neat, and that is in 4th edition D&D, Gamma World was basically just a version of D&D. I mean, the way it was set up, you used 4th edition D&D for Gamma World. And 4th edition Gamma World was basically a Hadron Collider blew up, and it caused a bunch of alternate realities to overlap. So it is post-apocalyptic, and also anything can freaking happen.
Those settings are a recent gnome cast episode talked about genre mashups, and that is your ultimate genre mashup, where you can take anything,
mm-hmm.
throw it in the blender, and have it be part of that world. It can be kind of exhausting for a GM to run, because you don't really have any boundaries on what is possible or what could be in the world, but it can also be a lot of fun.
Oh, yeah. Actually, the funny thing was, is we're just talking about this and like crossover and anything can happen. There was I cannot remember the name of the book series now, but it was written by Tracy Hickman and Margaret Weiss, and it was a science fiction series. However, depending on what part of space you were in, physics would change. So you would have this starship that was using like an ion drive engine, and they would get close to this boundary to another part of the universe, and they would have to unfurl their sails and have like a team of Pegasi start pulling the ship across space because the physics literally changed as they cross this boundary into another part of the universe.
Okay, that's funky.
we kind of touched on broader setting things and adventures, but what kind of elements are still in D&D now that are kind of science fiction crossover?
Obviously the constructs.
Oh, yeah.
We talked about the Warforged as a player species that they can choose to play, but there are also all the golems. A flesh golem is basically Frankenstein, which is from Mary Shelley, the mother of science fiction. Yes, I know in D&D, they're technically created by magic instead of science and lightning and a whole lot of luck, but it still is finding body parts, putting them together, and telling it, go do my bidding. There's also aberrations.
Oh, yeah. D&D aberrations very much pull from the Lovecraftian mythos. So it's kind of interesting because you have things that are that look like demons that are aliens, and you also have demons.
Yeah, there's a lot of science fiction-y, horror-feeling things you can do with aberrations.
One of the other things that I think is interesting is now they've consolidated the idea that most aberrations come from the Far Realm. And the idea with the Far Realm is that it is just this place where physics do not work the way they do in the regular D&D universe, which is also very Lovecraftian.
There's also psionics. Anytime you introduce psionics into your D&D game, you're adding a little bit of that science fiction flavor. I mean, it's basically the Force. You know, pulling it back to Star Wars.
Well, you know, we have to. It's either Star Wars or comic books. It's going to happen one way or the other.
Yeah.
But that's actually interesting because I think some of the pushback that I've seen on people not liking the feel of having psionics in their game is usually people that don't really want to cross over into science fiction elements. What's interesting is in first edition D&D, it was in there, but that's because a lot of these pulp books that inspired D&D had people that weren't necessarily wizards or anything, but they were telepathic, you know, or, you know, something like that, where they kind of made that distinction between somebody having mental powers and somebody that, you know, learned spells.
When I played in the 80s and 90s, the people I played with were very against psionics. So I never engaged with it until the third edition version came out, at which point I played a Kalashtar in our first Eberron game, and she was basically a psionic warrior.
Mm-hmm.
It was super cool. I thought it was a lot of fun. I am told by those who had played the original and played the third edition version is that the third edition version was cleaned up a lot to mesh much better with the existing game.
Second edition psionics were weird, especially when you look at like the psionics handbook, because there were some really wild things that were as powerful as higher level spells that you could get at much lower levels. And in order to trigger it, you had to roll lower than, you know, your stat for it. You were getting disintegrate a little bit sooner than anybody should reasonably have disintegrate.
Especially a second edition version of disintegrate.
Yeah.
At least in fifth edition, you get to save, and I think it does a max of 70 points of damage.
Yeah, yeah. And if you survive the damage, you don't get disintegrated. The other thing that is interesting to me about psionics in fifth edition is they've really kind of attached psionics to aberrations. Like, that is a big feeling of most things that have to do with psionics are things that have touched the Far Realm. So it's touching this thing that has broken physics compared to your own reality.
That makes sense. That makes sense. In Eberron, the Kalashtar are, I may screw up some of the specifics here, but the Kalashtar, they were part of the quarry that broke off when they came to the material plane, and they ended up bonding with humanoids to create this new species called the Kalashtar, which is basically a person who shares the soul with one of the quarry. And that quarry can be passed down the genetic line.
Mm-hmm.
It's a little bit like the Trill in Star Trek.
Yeah, yeah.
There's no manual passing it down. It's just when a Kalashtar passes, it can go find the next child in the line to bond with and so on and so forth. But it's the psionics come into it because they are from that other plane of existence.
The other thing I was just thinking about this as we're talking about aberrations and science fiction elements, there are some weird science fiction-y things with some of the more famous aberrations. Aboleths retain all of their memories, and their children have all the memories of their parents and continue to pass that on because they just basically clone themselves and everything, all their brainwaves and everything goes into the next generation. And that feels very science fiction-y to me, that there's the species that just passes everything on to the next generation.
That is pretty wild.
And I think at one point in time, one of the origins for Mind Flayers was that the Illithids were present at the end of the universe and sent themselves back in time to the past in order to control everything so that they could stop the universe from ending, but also be in charge of everything. Also a very science fiction-y plot element there.
Yes, that sounds like I'm going, Doctor Who?
So why would we want to add science fiction elements to our game?
Honestly, the first thing that comes to mind is because you want to change up the flavor of your game. Many of us have been playing D&D for literal decades. And sometimes, you know, as much as we love the tried and true tropes of the game and its settings, sometimes you want to spice it up a little bit without completely jumping ships. You know, you want to just throw in some science fiction elements and, you know, just change up the tone of the game a little bit. It's a way to turn things on their head.
I normally don't advocate for this, only this, but it is. It's a shock value thing. Like, sometimes it is worth it just to see the looks on someone's faces when they realize this thing they're fighting is actually a cyborg. Like, oh no.
This metal monstrosity.
Really, it's always about adding new plot elements that you can tell more stories about, though. That's also what kind of leads us into the next question, which is, how would you add science fiction elements to your game? What do you have to keep in mind?
You have to do it carefully.
Mm-hmm.
There is a balance between describing things the characters recognize and understand compared to what the players will recognize and understand. And if you lean too much towards describing only what the characters recognize, it can get very frustrating for the players.
Mm-hmm.
I bring this up because the very first campaign I ever played with my current group was D&D, but it was in a post-apocalyptic future of our world.
Mm-hmm.
It was set in essentially Texas, in and around Dallas. And when we went to the old city, the GM just, it was a very interesting thing he was trying to do, but sometimes he would describe things a little too obtusely.
Yeah.
You don't need to tell us that wall-to-wall carpeting is like grass. We've got carpets. We know what rugs are. You don't need to describe wall-to-wall carpeting as something. It's weird because we don't have wall-to-wall carpeting, but it's still like there were times where he would just lean into that. And it's just like, in some ways, it's very similar to the troll problem. If you are a D&D player who has been playing for a long time, you don't really want to have to pretend that you don't know that trolls are vulnerable to fire.
Mm-hmm.
It gets very tiring and old. In a game where you're trying to blend science fiction and fantasy, you have to walk a very careful line with your players and their characters so that you can keep that sense of wonder and discovery alive for them without frustrating the players because you're describing something really oddly and they have absolutely no idea what you're talking about when you're talking about something very simple like wall-to-wall carpeting.
It's funny because, first off, D&D settings are not Earth in the past. As much as people will sometimes say things like, that wouldn't happen back then. It's like, it's not back then. This is an alternate world that just happens to use swords and armor and kind of looks like our world in the past, but it's not. But even at that, there are people that really internalize some ahistorical things. And one of the things that reminds me of that is, like, yesterday, at the time that we're recording this, we just had the eclipse.
It was really cool. Even if there was complete cloud cover overhead, it was still really cool watching the world go dark and then go light again.
It's so funny because some people will swear, oh, someone from 1,000 years ago, if they saw this, would think that the world is ending. It's like, a lot of cultures tracked celestial things. They knew that this would happen every 20 years or so. They had calendars that predicted it. They didn't think the world was ending. They knew what an eclipse was. I realize in some cases, some cultures did put some supernatural importance on this thing, but assuming that everybody that was, you know, that is not a modern human being doesn't understand anything, it is a big pitfall.
That leans into some of the problems with the ancient alien thoughts and theories about the past, and it's assuming that every culture, especially cultures that weren't white, were extremely primitive and had no ability to understand the world around them. And that is really not true.
They'd have to know math and engineering to do this.
No shit, buddy.
Surely they didn't know math and engineering. Ancient Aliens is a very bad trope, and try and avoid it if you can.
Yeah, I mean, like, I've got no problem with saying, yes, they might have put supernatural significance on it, or that, you know, people in an isolated area that didn't know it was coming might be a little afraid. And seriously, animals do act weird.
Yeah, oh yeah.
A lot of the birds began their night songs. The frog peepers started making their noises. Because, well, it's dark. It's time to go to work. No, bud. No. Go back to sleep. It's fine. It's fine.
It's interesting, too. I think that there is a way to use these things without assuming the extreme. And I think at this point, I'll just point you at the movie Lady Hawk.
Lady Hawk. It's really hard for a modern audience to watch it. It really is. The music is something else.
It's very interesting because it was like early 80s synth in a medieval story.
I have such fond memories of that movie. It's such a romantic story. I do have a friend who made her husband sit down and watch it within the last few years, and he was just like, what the hell is this?
And Lady Hawk is not the weirdest fantasy movie that was done in the 80s. It definitely is not.
Oh, no. There's so more. So many more.
I mean, there aren't even any Muppets in it.
Hey, you leave Farscape alone.
I was just going to say, one of the things that I worry about, too, is understand that certain worlds have certain themes, certain stories have certain themes, and science fiction may not fit with that. I would have no problem having somebody in the Forgotten Realms find a laser cannon. That's a thing that I could see happen because Faerun has portals to other worlds, and that's a thing, you know, people travel back and forth there.
And also, who the hell knows what the Netherese might have done, because they did a whole lot of stupid stuff.
But then, on the other hand, I don't think I would do that in Dragonlance. Because Dragonlance is very much a setting where it's not like the gods showed up and kind of did things, but also evolution works and all this. No, literally the gods did everything. Everything is mythic in Dragonlance. So there wouldn't be random aliens that came out of nowhere that would crash on the planet.
That kind of leans into that genre mixing that we talked about. And sometimes it works. Sometimes it's just going to break your game.
Oh, yeah, definitely. What kind of tools are there still sitting around in the D&D toolbox that you could throw into your game to get some science fiction elements?
Well, the most forgotten resource of 5th edition, the Dungeon Master's Guide, actually has a lot of cool stuff in it, including weapons from other eras. It amazes me how many people say things with absolute certainty, completely ignoring or forgetting the fact that the DMG actually covers that option.
What's hilarious about that, too, is if you go into D&D Beyond and just look up any magic item that says any for weapon type, you will start seeing things like Infernal Laser Cannon. Because it's just attaching it to a weapon that was defined in the Dungeon Master's Guide. But yeah, there's several, like, there's laser cannons and disintegrator rifles, and there's modern weaponry, so there's submachine guns and grenades, so have at it, have fun, you know, especially, I know this is going to sound bad, especially grenades, because they're not going to be a long-term thing that your party can deal with. They're going to throw them, and then they're done. But I mean, that's also kind of a self-correcting problem you have with some technology, too, because maybe that laser cannon has 10 shots.
Right there, let's take a moment and talk about the Artificer. The Artificer is a class available in the game that is a tinkerer that makes stuff. Yes, they're kind of infusing it with magic, but at the same time, it is magic blended with a technology. And if you are going to allow artificers into your game, you are going to be engaging with a degree of at least a steampunk kind of style of science fiction.
The funny thing about that is one of the subclasses of Artificer is basically Iron Man.
Yep.
I will half take back something I said in the last section, because I think you can introduce artificers into Kryn, because there is a history of like tinker gnomes building things. I just wouldn't put like alien artifacts into Kryn.
I would be very careful about doing the post-apocalyptic far future our past technology, lost civilization type stuff in Kryn.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Kind of undermines the point of it.
There's Spelljammer.
I would go on the rant again, except fifth edition Spelljammer did things like giving space clowns ray guns. So it leans a little more heavily into some of the science fiction tropes compared to the second edition version of Spelljammer. There's a whole thing that Kobold Press put out, The Wastes of Chaos, and it's a bunch of different examples of post-apocalyptic settings that you can use. And one of those is basically a post-apocalypse after a technological society has fallen. So it has a bunch of like fifth edition stats for science fiction-y type weapons and armor and things of that nature. Kobold Press also has some weird things like the Ahu-Nixta, which are cyborgs that come from another reality to scavenge things in this reality. And it's just like this weird fleshy face and a ball of cyborg with tentacles on it. But it's all a science fiction-y thing.
There's actually a lot of games out there that use the 5th edition SRD that lean more towards science fiction. Esper Genesis, I believe, is one of them.
Yeah, yeah. It's a space opera 5th edition based game.
Even though it has its own system, Numenera from Monte Cook Games did some 5e versions, and that is absolutely the ultimate version of its far future. Past civilizations have fallen. You now get to play in the ruins of everything.
Yeah, when I first read the background behind Numenera, my first thought was, this is like high concept version of Thundar the Barbarian. Instead of like thousands of years in the future, it's millions. But yeah, it's that same thing. And
yeah,
some of those books have some neat, again, some neat one-shot technological items that you can use that you don't have to worry about changing the campaign too much. Because your players are going to use it once and then it's gone.
Now, I will say I haven't had a chance. I haven't played a Numenera campaign because I have trouble wrapping my head around the setting because it is so far in the future and so focused on the weird little artifacts you find. I don't know how my character lives in that world.
Mm-hmm.
I have trouble anchoring my concept to a character that lives and breathes in that world. But that may just be me.
I think they put out a second edition of the setting where it's a little bit more focused on saying what you do as an adventurer in this setting is go out and find weird artifacts to help stabilize your home and build things up. And it created more of this idea. Like, it's not just here's this weird setting with all this stuff and play someone in it. It was more like this is what an adventurer does. So you have a baseline to start with.
But it does speak to some of the issues you can run into when trying to mix science fiction into your fantasy. You have to be a little careful about how you go about it, and you have to make sure it's something your players are going to be on board with.
Yeah, definitely. The other thing, we were talking about monsters before in Kobold Press, but the MCDM book, Flea Mortals, they have their own creatures that stand in for mind flayers in that setting, except all of them are statted to carry ray guns with them.
Like a mind flayer needs a ray gun. They are a ray gun.
But then the other thing is they have kind of a stand-in for the Githyanki, who also have laser guns. So there is a little bit of that crossover in there. And while it is not D&D, the MCDM RPG is definitely going to include some of those things where it's like, oh, we're fighting dragons, but we happen to find a jetpack.
I wouldn't put it past an artificer.
Time for rest, you two. Get on with your downtime research.
Every episode, we're going to look for something related to D&D that we want to pass along to you, our listeners. It might be products, websites, videos, podcasts, but will always be something we think is going to enhance your D&D experience. Speaking of other fantasy games, there is an update to the Daggerheart playtest. I think it's 1.3 or something like that.
Yeah.
This is the game from Darrington Press, which is the publishing arm of the Critical Role group. So it's definitely going to be fantasy. We, i.e. me and Jared, should have something to say about this soon because we're getting to try out a playtest soon. So we'll have more later, and there'll be a link to the playtest in our show notes.
And I did kind of do a quick glance over, and what I'm glad for is they are taking outside advice, but they didn't gut the game and follow exactly what some people online were saying, which I appreciate.
Good.
My suggestion is just going to be, I have the Nord Games, the Oracle Story Generator box set, which is a box set with a bunch of different decks for generating the outline of an adventure. You just draw things from this deck and this deck and this deck, and you put them together. You have what the characters are going on their quest for, who opposes them, what the complication is. I love that deck, and it is something that I used to, you know, jumpstart the campaign that I'm running for my daughter and her friends. But they also, Nord Games has a couple more on the way. One of them is a character generator, which I'm not quite sure what the different decks do in the character generator, but I still want it because they're pretty cards, and I can't resist pretty cards.
Jared is part goblin.
Yeah, it's true. But what I really wanted to mention is, again, we always have the problem with Kickstarters where if we mention a Kickstarter, it may be over by the time this episode comes out. But Nord Games has a Kickstarter that has not started yet. So you can go and follow it on Kickstarter. And if it has started by the time this episode drops, don't worry about it. I'm pretty sure it hasn't finished up yet. But this one is going to be a monster generator. And I am really interested to see what exactly goes into randomly drawing cards to build a monster in 5th edition.
That'll be pretty cool.
We are happily part of the Polygamers Podcast Network, helping you run and play your best games. We think you'll enjoy another Polygamers podcast, like
the Gnomecast. Several gnomes from Gnome Stew get together to talk about gaming topics and themselves in an effort to entertain you and avoid being thrown in the stew.
We have used up all of our resources, including those really neat void grenades that we found. So I think it's time for a long rest. I hope this adventure was rewarding for you. We hope you'll be exploring with us when we start our next adventure.